From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We will get you updated on the news that made headlines this past week. And today our panel includes Kevin Richer, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Ian Max Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, Sydney Kidd with Boise Dev, and Julie Lucchetta with Boise State Public Radio. And today we are beginning with a story that has made headlines nationally, even internationally. It is a lawsuit brought by four women over Idaho's abortion laws. And our Julie Lucchetta has been covering this, and she's joining us now to talk more about this. So Julie, as I mentioned, you've been covering this trial since the very beginning. Can you tell us about the case, who brought it, and what are they arguing?
So this is a lawsuit that was brought in through the Center for Reproductive Rights. And as you mentioned, they are representing four patients and two physicians who are saying that Idaho's abortion bans that went into effect after the repeal of Roe v. Wade go against Idahoans' constitutional rights to happiness and safety as delineated by the Idaho Constitution, and that the way the bans are written are too medically vague, causing confusion for physicians as to when exactly they are allowed to intervene to provide an abortion. Because something to understand is, while Idaho has one of the most restrictive abortion bans in the country, it does allow exceptions in the case of rape and incest. So if a pregnancy is the result of rape or incest, but for the purpose of this trial, specifically this lawsuit, the crux of the issue brought on by this case is the exemption to allow abortions to allow abortions when the life of the mother is in danger of imminent death. And that is, according to physicians, a confusing and vague wording, because there is a myriad of ways in which pregnancies can get complicated, mm-hmm. and they are unsure at what point in a complication they are allowed to intervene. And obviously they feel they have a responsibility not just to preserve the life of someone who is in crisis, who, you know, is coding, who is on the verge of death, but also to intervene as medical professionals before someone's health deteriorates. And as you may know, pregnancies, there's as many pregnancy complications as there are pregnancies, and they feel that the literal language of the law is just too broad or too narrow, just doesn't really factor in the reality of practicing medicine on pregnant women.
So, Julie, you mentioned that the plaintiffs say Idaho's law is medically vague. And can we talk a little bit about that and why they're saying that? Is it because, as you mentioned, right now it says, okay, life of the mother, right? If the mother's life is in danger. But as we know, and as these women testified to, is that when does that go from the health of the mother to saving her life? Is this the area where these plaintiffs are arguing?
Yes, absolutely. It's the reality is pregnancies can go wrong, and unfortunately many of them do. And the plaintiffs experienced their own medical complications during a very much wanted pregnancies earlier on in the pregnancy, in the third or fourth month of the pregnancy. And they determined with their medical team that the pregnancies were just not viable, and carrying them to term posed great and severe risks to their health, first and foremost, but potentially all the way up to, you know, their lives. Mm. And the text of Idaho statute does not really determine all the scenarios that can happen that will eventually lead to severe complications that can impact a woman's future ability to carry children, that can impact, you know, that can result in the loss of organs, mm-hmm. or that can like severely disable them after the pregnancy. And so that is what they're arguing. That is what the plaintiffs are arguing, that this law is kind of a legal document, not a medical one, able to fully capture the reality that physicians are faced with every day, which is considering individual cases of pregnancy with patients' individual, you know, health, mm-hmm. bodies, et cetera, and making a determination with the patients of what makes more sense for them.
So, Julie, the four women in Idaho who brought this lawsuit along with these doctors, can you explain this? My understanding is they actually don't want to overturn the law, correct? They want clarification,
yes.
on what counts as a medical exception.
Exactly. So this is not a lawsuit that is going after the abortion ban. It wants to clarify in the ban to expand the exemption to mm-hmm. allow providers to provide abortions if the patient has severe complications, if the patient has pre-existing conditions that are volatile enough that a pregnancy can only lead to, you know, severe health outcomes or death, mm-hmm. and in the case of a lethal fetal diagnosis, which includes a variety of either genetic or developmental issues while the pregnancy is ongoing, that can be diagnosed at certain moments in the development of the pregnancy, where, you know, the fetus is just not viable and has mm-hmm. has no chance of survival. And under current Idaho code, physicians are arguing they do not feel comfortable knowing at what point they can determine that an abortion is considered necessary.
Well, in fact, Julie, in the first 15 months after Idaho's abortion law went into effect, more than one-fifth of OBGYNs have actually stopped practicing in our state. In fact, The Guardian interviewed almost a dozen of those doctors. And during this trial, some physicians testified to the fact that they're not just concerned about jail time. They're concerned about losing their medical license. And in fact, one physician, I believe she's out of Mountain Home, Dr. Nicole Aker, said since the law doesn't use medical terms, it's difficult mm-hmm. to decipher. She called it, and I'm quoting here, legal jargon yep. that she didn't learn in medical school. She learned medical terminology, medical diagnoses. So tell us about what some of these doctors testified to.
Well, before I do that, let me just set this up by saying the Idaho abortion ban does not criminalize women who receive mm-hmm. abortions, but it does criminalize physicians and anyone who participates in providing an abortion. So everyone in the room, nurses, et cetera, et cetera. And providers who perhaps provide abortions outside of the boundaries of the law can face felony charges, up to 5 years in prison, and, as you mentioned, lose their medical license. So the stakes for them are very high, which is why the study from the Idaho Coalition for Safe Healthcare that came out last year showed that 22% of OBGYN have left the state since the bans went into effect. And in their assessment, the direct causation of this is physicians just not wanting to deal with the potential risk of them providing what they deem to be medically necessary pregnancy termination and then facing, you know, a trial, courtroom, and all the kind of professional and personal consequences that entails. Mm-hmm. And so that's what this Dr. Aker is saying is, as a doctor, they know, you know, they're trained for years, and as several experts testified last week and this week as witnesses for the plaintiffs, there are so many different types of medical complications, of types of pregnancies, and all these things, and none of those kind of complicated scenarios are captured in the law. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a cursory reading of the law makes it seem pretty clear that the only time that a physician can intervene is if the pregnant patient is at risk of death. But what does that mean? If someone is diagnosed with something that has a very, very likely chance of developing into a kind of a crisis within a month. Mm-hmm. Does this mean the doctors have to kind of sit tight and wait until the woman's health deteriorates to the point of emergency for them to intervene? Or can they, you know, based on their wealth of knowledge, statistics, discussions with risk and the patients, can they determine, okay, we don't want to make you go through this, through the risk of miscarriage, preeclampsia, all that stuff, because we want to make sure that you are healthy. And so I think that's the main issue, is that they don't know where the line is drawn.
Julie, you've been in the courtroom throughout the trial. I'm curious if you could take us there. What has it been like in that room? I mean, what have reactions been in court to this testimony? Because I think so many of us have seen at least clips of these four women giving their testimony. Not only was it graphic, but it was heartbreaking. So I'm just curious as to what it's been like sitting there in that courtroom.
So this trial is happening in Ada County here in Boise. One thing to know about it is it is not a jury trial. It's a bench trial, meaning the determination, the ruling following this trial will be made by the judge presiding over the trial, Judge Jason Scott. So it's kind of a small room. There's one side, there's a, you know, kind of a setup for the plaintiff's legal team. Then there's the setup for the defendants representing the state of Idaho. And then there's just kind of a place for witnesses to come in and answer questions by both parties' legal teams. In the courtroom, it's kind of a small room. There's like some space for the public to attend. And it was mostly packed on the first day of the trial because I suspect it focused specifically on the, as you mentioned, very emotional testimony of these four women who kind of walked people through what they endured when they first realized that their wanted pregnancy was not viable and came with a lot of potential risks. And so they described that process of grief, of learning, the loss of their pregnancy, and then kind of walked folks through the added trauma of having to figure out the logistics of, you know, packing your bags and driving hundreds of miles to a place that you are not familiar with a medical team that you don't know, the whole time wondering if, you know, while you're driving on the road, if something might happen, if your pregnancy might escalate. And so those were very, very emotional, mm-hmm. very emotional testimonies. And in the room the first day, there was seemingly a lot of family members, husbands, some of the women's children were there as well. I know at one point when one woman, while she was describing, you know, tearfully having to having to go through a stillbirth in a foreign clinic. I know what I assume is her partner holding their toddler was sobbing. So it was kind of a heavy day in court.
So Julie, at this point, the trial has wrapped up. They are going to do closing arguments. That's set though for about 6 weeks from now.
Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned, it's a bench trial. So Judge Scott will write a written decision. I'm assuming we don't know, but it could be the first of the year before there is a decision on this case.
Yeah. I mean, I have stopped trying to speculate or plan my schedule around when we ever hear back from trials, but so what happened, I know, it was reported that the trial was closed, but it was mostly put on pause. We did not hear yesterday closing arguments from either parties. So this means that throughout the last 2 weeks, the plaintiffs and the defendants called upon all these witnesses, provided all this evidence. And usually at the end of that process, both sides get to, have their moment where they kind of recap everything that they've presented in support of one ruling or another. We did not get to that point because of the kind of complicated medical jargon and all of the information that was shared. Both parties decided that before they make their closing statements, they needed to review everything that was said. So they're waiting for the official transcripts of the trial, everything that was said in the last 2 weeks. And they have 6 weeks after they receive those transcripts to kind of review them, to look over, pour over the evidence, and then come up with the next steps. So then they will, within 6 weeks, they will do that. Then potentially have to schedule another time to do closing arguments. And then only after that will the judge be able to make a ruling. But the judge also himself has to review everything. So that could take weeks. And so it's unclear if this will happen before the end of the year.
All right, Julie, appreciate that reporting on this. So Kevin, the debate over Boise State University women's volleyball team forfeiting two games this season, well, it's continuing to heat up. But before we dig into all of that, can you give us background on this for folks who may not have been paying close attention?
Yeah, this has unfolded throughout the volleyball season, and it began in late September when Boise State announced that it was forfeiting a match at San Jose State. They announced it the day before the match and never really publicly explained the reasons behind the forfeit. And they've subsequently forfeited a second match involving San Jose State that would have taken place in Boise. I think just yesterday was the scheduled date for it. Again, no public comments really from Boise State, but very clear from the context and very clear also from public records that we received, other reporters have received as well, that this all centers around one player on the San Jose State roster who is reportedly a transgender athlete. That has never been confirmed by the university. That's never been publicly, the player I don't think has ever publicly commented. That's the crux of this. And it's become part of a much larger debate over transgender athletics. It's involved now several, four schools now in the Mountain West Conference have also forfeited matches against San Jose State. So this has been going on since late September. It's kind of coming to a crescendo now, both in a federal courtroom and next week when the Mountain West Conference has its postseason volleyball tournament.
Okay, so according to your reporting, Kevin, you wrote, it's been 8 weeks, two forfeits, one federal lawsuit. And what are we hearing from Boise State about any of that?
Very, very little, which is why I had to submit public records requests. Other reporters with the Statesman, Boise State Public Radio, among others, have submitted public records requests to try to figure out what exactly was going on behind the scenes. And what we do know behind the scenes is that there was a lot of discussion involving the athletic department, administrators in the athletic department, players on the Boise State women's volleyball roster, university administrators, and opponents of transgender athletes lobbying Boise State to forfeit the match. So there have been a lot of a lot of players involved in this whole debate and this whole discussion, which has taken place almost exclusively behind closed doors.
And I know, Kevin, you and other media outlets have contacted Boise State directly. When you've done this, they have basically directed you to another entity, correct?
In terms of the lawsuit, I should be clear that they have said nothing at all about the lawsuit. They've said very little about the forfeits. And really, they only responded to questions from me about the forfeits after we had sifted through a lot of public records. We had we had a pretty clear trail that suggested how and why the forfeits took place, who was involved in that decision. At that point, Boise State did answer some of our questions. But the lawsuit that's going on in federal court in Colorado, that was filed last week. Boise State is not commenting on the lawsuit. They've referred us back to the Mountain West Conference, which is a defendant in the lawsuit.
Okay, so tell us about this federal lawsuit, because even though Boise State is not directly involved in the lawsuit, two Boise State volleyball players signed on to this federal lawsuit.
Yes, two players on the volleyball team, two sisters who are on the roster, are among the 12 plaintiffs in the case. And what they're trying to do in this lawsuit, they're seeking several remedies in court. And they want them fairly quickly because, as I mentioned, the Mountain West's volleyball tournament is taking place next week in Las Vegas. What they want is either for San Jose State's volleyball team to be declared ineligible, to have all of their victories on and off the court stricken from the record, San Jose State banned from the conference tournament. If not that, they have asked the court to take away the six wins that San Jose State has received via forfeit, including the two wins that they received from forfeits involving Boise State. The crux of the lawsuit is that they feel like this policy from the Mountain West Conference that mandates forfeits if a team forfeits a game or a match involving possibly a transgender athlete, that that's a violation of, among other things, the player's right to protest, the player's First Amendment right to protest. So that's kind of one of the many legal arguments in this case, and it's 132 pages of lawsuit. So there's a whole lot there. There's a lot about whether this player would have a competitive advantage, whether this player is stronger, more powerful, more forceful, capable of spiking a volleyball at a higher rate of speed that puts other players at risk of concussions. So a lot about biology and about arguments about competitive advantage, but also a lot about free speech and players on these teams feeling like their free speech rights have been compromised.
Well, and also getting back to these forfeits, Kevin, I mean, that's really put San Jose State in a much better position than Boise State. I mean, those two forfeits impacted their standings in the rankings, yes?
They did, definitely. As I look at the numbers and they're laid out in the lawsuit, there's no question it has helped San Jose State move up the conference standings. And I believe only the top six teams in the Mountain West Conference, and I think there are 11 schools that have volleyball teams, so only the top six of those 11 make it to the tournament. So there's actually been some question about, is San Jose State taking a spot in the tournament at the expense of other schools that, or another school that might qualify otherwise, especially if the plaintiffs got their way and San Jose State was declared ineligible. So, yeah, there's a lot in terms of that conference tournament and the stakes involving what happens at that conference tournament, because the winner of the conference tournament goes on to the NCAA tournament, the national championship.
And Kevin, before we wrap this up, I mean, there's another wrinkle in this, and that's the fact that Boise State will likely be leaving the Mountain West in 2026. So does that play into it, right?
There are so many wrinkles in this story, and that's what I found really interesting. Not just about Boise State, but about Utah State. Uh-huh. So let me take back. So yes, Boise State, early in September, before this whole volleyball thing came out, by the way, Boise State announced that it was leaving the Mountain West Conference, planning to leave the Mountain West in 2026 to join this reconstituted version of the Pac-12. Utah State is another one of the Mountain West schools that has announced that it's planning to go to the Pac-12, but very different approaches between those two schools that are basically now Mountain West short-timers. Boise State has steered away from this lawsuit. They've steered away from criticizing the Mountain West. They've steered away from this whole dispute between the players and the plaintiffs and the Mountain West. Utah State is now a party to this lawsuit. They have signed on as an intervener, which means they are now another plaintiff in the case. So Utah State, like Boise State, planning to leave the Mountain West in a couple of years, they are involved now in the lawsuit against the Mountain West Conference. Very, very different. Different dynamics, though, too. Utah State was pressured by the governor down there and legislative leaders who wanted to see Utah State weigh in and become involved in this lawsuit. As far as I can tell, Boise State is making its decision on its own. It has not received, certainly hasn't received any public pressure from political leaders to intervene in this lawsuit. And I've not been able to get any evidence that there's been behind the scenes lobbying from political leaders. There could be. I just have not seen any proof of that.
All right. Well, this is definitely not the last. I'm sure we will be hearing about all of this. With that,
no, the lawsuit is still pending.
Yeah, it's still pending. Okay, thanks, Kevin. So, Ian, I want to talk about an influential Christian lobbying group, and I believe they're based here in Idaho, that plans to bring a bill forward in the upcoming legislative session that would require all public schools in our state to read the Bible. Talk to us about this.
Yeah, so this is a group called the Idaho Family Policy Center. They are based here in Idaho, and they tend to be pretty influential and to have a fair amount of purchase in the legislature. They have, in past legislative sessions, been involved in writing bills, writing some of Idaho's abortion bans, as well as some of the limits on transgender rights as well. So in the past, they've had, you know, in frequent instances where lawmakers have sponsored or helped incorporate their ideas and their bills into legislation. So that's part of why I think this is a notable proposal that they've come forward with, which is that next year in the upcoming legislative session, they want to introduce a bill that, as you said, would require all public schools to read the Bible. And specifically, it would be a requirement that they read the entirety of the Bible in public schools without commenting on, it's not exactly, they're not supposed to comment on the substance of the Bible verses, but they would be supposed to read it over a 10-year period. So that would equate to roughly 20 verses per school day. That's the proposal here. And it's certainly, you know, this is something I think that listeners may have seen other states trying as well. In Oklahoma, there's a requirement now that the Bible be read in public schools. Texas, actually just today, the school board, I saw a headline that the school board has passed some, a committee has passed some curriculum design to bring Christian teaching into the school curriculum there. Louisiana has also passed a law to have the Ten Commandments displayed in public school classrooms. And I think what we're seeing here, you know, can kind of be loosely described as forms of Christian nationalism, which is essentially an effort to aim for government policy to incorporate or endorse tenets of the Christian faith, you know, in school teaching. And in this instance, the Idaho Family Policy Center believes that government should promote Christian values. And so that's why they want to see the Bible brought into the classroom. And so, you know, we'll be seeing if this is something that lawmakers decide to take up in the coming session. The center wouldn't tell me whether they have any sponsors of the bill yet. They say that they, you know, they like to wait until the session to see if, you know, to bring forward a bill. So it's not clear yet if any specific lawmakers have sponsored this and plan to bring it forward, but I'm sure we'll find out come January.
Okay. Sydney, very quickly, before we go to break, folks should prepare themselves for some significant develop in Meridian. Tell us about the gateway at 10 Mile and start with how many homes are going to be built.
Yep. So it's going to be about 390 homes, and that's going to be a mix of apartments and townhomes. It is a mixed use project though, so there's also some there's a commercial aspect to it, but this development happened, or it's been in the works since at least 2020, when the city of Meridian annexed the property into city boundaries with a development agreement. So it came before the city council this week, and basically all the city council had to do was see if it was in line with that 2020 development agreement, and if it was, then the project would have to be approved.
Okay. So, Kevin, one of our state's most prominent education leaders met with PragerU reps back in January. Tell us about PragerU. What is this?
PragerU is founded by Dennis Prager, who's a conservative commentator, and it is a form of curriculum that's available now in several states, and it is unabashedly conservative. In fact, it is unabashedly designed to be an offset to what the founders say is left-wing ideology that's pervasive in public education. So in October, State Superintendent Debbie Critchfield announced that the PragerU curriculum would be available to Idaho school districts for use for free. Now, you have to remember that curriculum decisions are made at the local level. The state does not establish a statewide curriculum. It's up to the 115 school districts, the 70 plus charters in the state, to determine at the local level what curriculum they want to use. When Superintendent Critchfield announced that PragerU was going to be available, we talked to her. Our Carly Flandreau, who's been following the story, talked to Critchfield and said, well, where did this all come from? And Critchfield said that she had been contacted sometime around June. She said June-ish, sometime in the summer from she was contacted by a district in the Treasure Valley. She couldn't remember which, or didn't say which, who was interested in trying to add the PragerU curriculum. So that's where she said that the conversations began. So Carly went and asked for the public records. She asked for the emails between PragerU and the State Department of Education. And what she found was that PragerU began reaching out to the State Department of Education late last year and was talking with, exchanging email with Greg Wilson, who is one of Critchfield's top assistants, back in January. And had really been kind of pushing to have a meeting, to have a conversation with Critchfield about their curriculum. So it really does go back quite a bit further than was originally presented to us. And definitely there was a push from PragerU. It wasn't just a school district asking for the opportunity to use this curriculum.
So Kevin, as you said, I mean, curriculum is set at the local level. So what, even though this is available, what does this potentially mean then for our public schools?
That is going to be one of the things we'll watch closely in the months ahead. Who actually uses this curriculum? Who looks at this and says this is something that they want to work into the mix or use exclusively as curriculum? Some districts, and Critchfield said this from the beginning, she said some districts will look at this and say, this isn't for us. And that's fine, because again, these are local decisions. So I will be really curious to see if this is used, how widespread it is used. And once it is in the classrooms, at that point, what is the reaction in the communities? What do parents say about this? What do patrons say about it? What do teachers say about using this curriculum? Definitely a story that we'll be watching closely.
Okay, thanks for that. Ian, talk to us about why the Idaho State Police have been vetting the mail over at the Secretary of State's office, and they've been doing this since September. So what's going on?
Yeah, I spoke with the Secretary of State's office yesterday, and they told me that back in September, a number of states, over 20 states, received a package that included a threatening manifesto and, in many cases, sort of a white powdery substance along with it that was reviewed and considered by law enforcement to be threatening, and the package. And Idaho is among these states that actually received one of these packages. I learned yesterday, it had a return address in Oklahoma that was described on the package as United States Traitor Elimination Army. And what the Secretary of State's office told me was that the package was actually intercepted before it even reached the Idaho Capitol. The Postal Service was able to flag it, and it was taken to a lab for testing, and it was determined that the substance inside was not harmful. But nonetheless, the Idaho State Police subsequently, and in the run-up to the election, offered to, as a precautionary measure, open the mail and sort of review and vet the mail that the mm-hmm. Secretary of State's office receives, just to ensure that there aren't any safety concerns with the mail they're receiving. And so they've been doing that since September up through the election, and they plan to do it through the end of the year. And I think this is, you know, something nationwide. A lot of places have seen kind of an escalation of heated debate and argument around elections, which has in many cases led to threats towards officials and the like. Mm-hmm. And so the Secretary of State's office told me that the FBI has been investigating this matter. And as far as I know, there haven't been any, conclusions made about specifically who sent it. But they told me that it was thought that it was sent by a group loosely associated with the Sovereign Citizens Movement, which is essentially a network of conspiracy theorists and anti-government activists. So, that's what I learned. It'll likely be through the end of the year that they'll still be reviewing the Secretary of State's office mail.
Okay. So, Sydney, the Meridian Parks and Rec Department are planning an expansion at Settlers Park. They brought a plan before the city council earlier this week. They purchased some additional land earlier this year, correct? So what are they planning on doing?
Yeah, so you're right. They purchased 11 acres from the West Ada School District. The school district said it didn't need the land anymore. And so now what the city is trying to do, what the Parks and Rec Department is trying to do, is to expand Settlers Park to provide more parking, some dog park areas, and then also the big gem of this all that they're trying to get to come to pass is this community center. It would be over 22,000 square feet. And right now, the proposed plan is to have a large flex space, about the size of an elementary school gym, 3 multi-purpose classrooms, some specialty classrooms for things like cooking classes, art classes, things like that, and then some possible office space for like the fire department or other departments within the city to use. And the whole goal of this is to be something that the city could grow into. And so they've got this plan, but they're going to be bringing it forward to the public to get their input on it. And there's a community open house scheduled for Thursday, December 5th at 5 p.m. for people to bring their feedback to this project.
So, Ian, talk to us about a recent trip that the Idaho Attorney General, Raul Labrador, took down to Florida, but specifically to Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah, so last week, Attorney General Raul Labrador attended a conservative gala event at Mar-a-Lago in Trump's home base in Florida. The event was hosted by the America First Policy Institute, which is a influential Republican or conservative think tank that has a lot of influence in the coming Trump administration. And Labrador was there. It was a pretty star-studded gala. Other attendees included House Speaker Mike Johnson, Argentina's president, Javier Milei, who Labrador actually posted a photo with him on the platform X, as well as RFK Jr., Matt Gaetz, Elon Musk, and other figures who have either been appointed to be in the coming Trump administration or are otherwise likely to be kind of major figures once the president-elect's term begins. Labrador was there last week at this event, it seems like he was excited, obviously, about the victory of President-elect Donald Trump, and so went down to Florida to celebrate with this gala, which actually turns out was the first public speech that Trump had given since his victory earlier this month.
So Kevin, as we do gear up for another Trump administration and the possibility of a worldwide wrestling executive running the Department of Education, what could all of this mean for education? I mean, maybe besides wrestling in schools? I mean, I jest, but, you know.
Well, I don't know if we're going to the four R's where we go to reading, writing, arithmetic, and wrestling. But Linda McMahon, as you said, is an executive with WWE, World Wrestling Entertainment. She is also, she served on Connecticut's State Board of Education. She was head of the Small Business Administration under the first Trump administration. So mm-hmm. she's not, you know, without a resume beyond wrestling. What will be interesting to watch with the Trump administration on education issues, it's twofold. Trump has made no secret of the fact that he'd like to get rid of the education department at the federal level entirely. That's not a new proposal. That's been mm-hmm. kicked around since the 80s. Whether it gains any traction this time around, it's a little early to tell. You got to remember that whether you get rid of the federal education department or not, states like Idaho receive a lot of federal funding for education, even before the pandemic and the surge mm-hmm. of pandemic money. The state was receiving about $250 million of federal money for education. And that really, a lot of that goes towards poorer school districts. A lot of it goes towards special education. So a lot of it really does go into programs that serve at-risk students. More globally, I'll be interested to see what the Trump administration tries to do in education topics, but I suspect that it's a lot of what we see discussed at the state level. I mm-hmm. would imagine we'll see a big push towards eliminating DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. We're seeing that discussion happening at the state level. The State Board of Education was talking about a DEI policy just Thursday. I suspect we'll see a lot of talk about hot button issues like transgender issues, like we talked mm-hmm. about in the segment earlier today. A lot of talk probably about private school choice, which will be a huge issue at the 2025 legislative session. So what we see at the federal level probably isn't going to be very different than what we see at the state level. There's definitely going to be a blurring between the two.
And Kevin, I think it's fair to note, because a lot of people are concerned about this idea of dissolving the Department of Education. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it literally would take an act of Congress to decimate the Department of Education, to get rid of it.
It would. And obviously the Republicans now have both houses have control over both houses.
Right.
So if it came down to strictly partisan politics, they might be able to cobble together the votes. But, you know, I go back to the fact that this has been something that's been talked about since Ronald Reagan's first mm-hmm. year in office, 1981. He wanted to get rid of the Department of Education. It hasn't happened yet. So I suspect we'll see discussion about it, maybe a push towards it. But a lot of history would suggest that that's going to be a pretty heavy lift.
Right. Well, with that said, I want to thank all of our reporters today for taking time to talk with us. Appreciate all of you. I would also encourage everyone to read up on all of the articles written that we've talked about today. They go more in depth. We have great journalism here in our state. So I thank all of you, Kevin Richards, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Ian Max Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, and Sydney Kidd with BoiseDev.com, along with our own Julie Lucchetta, who joined us for the very first segment, talking about where we are with this abortion trial that is on hold, but will commence in 6 weeks for closing arguments. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.